This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, Sharat, we are fortunate to be joined by an iconic figure in Malaysian academic history and Malaysian history in general. And I'm referring to Dr. Syed Hussein Ali, a social anthropologist, historian, former senator. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
So I guess let's just start with a brief update. How have you been lately?
Well, lately I've been quite busy doing two things, actually. Reading and writing. Reading mainly historical history books and documents, because I'm now turning my interest into people's history. Writing, of course, one of the reasons why I withdrew from holding position in the party as deputy president of Parti Keadilan Rakyat was to concentrate on writing. And I've been writing since then. You know, I left about 4 years ago. And I've produced a few books, published a few books since then, as I had produced much earlier. So these things keep me busy, actually.
And this is part of your capacity as chair of Pusat Sejarah Rakyat?
Yes, right? I am now the chair of Pusat Sejarah Rakyat.
Obviously, you know, we've known each other for many years now, yes, but there may be people in the younger generation that don't really know you. Where did you grow up and how did your interest turn towards the social sciences? How did you end up becoming the person that you were in the early days?
Well, I was born in Batu Pahat, Johor, you know, and my secondary education, primary education were in Batu Pahat. Then for a while in Johor Bahru for my pre-university school.
And were you in English college?
English college, yeah, that's right, yes. And in 1956, I entered the University of Malaya, which was then in Singapore. And there, of course, I did the usual 3-4 subjects in the first year. And then I qualified to do Malay studies, although I wanted at that time to do economics, you know. But I was not a good student of economics, and I did Malay studies. And from there, of course, we had several streams in Malay studies, the literature stream, the cultural stream, as well as the linguistic streams. And then I did culture. And culture, of course, involved sociology, anthropology, and the rest of it, you know. Now, I was interested, of course, in society as such, and especially rural society, because I was concerned about development among Malays, but poverty among Malays particularly. And after graduating, I followed the president of the Smallholders Association to various kampung, especially in Johor. And I became more concerned about issues of the smallholders and the Malays at that time. So I said, well, why not do further studies on this, you know, write a thesis on the condition of Malays.
Is that your background as well? I mean, your family and their circumstance. Did you come from a peasant family, or were you part of the urban elite of Batu Pahat?
Well, I was urban in that sense, but it was my family was a poor family. You know, my father was a gravestone maker. And of course, even until I was in university, I was helping him during holidays, you know, to make gravestone.
Batu Nisan, isn't it?
Batu Nisan, yeah, that's Batu Nisan. Right. Yes.
Can you explain a bit about how the cultural and political milieu of Singapore in the '50s shaped you? Because I think at that time it was a vibrant time.
Yeah, I mean, 54, yes, PAP was, is only formed in 54, yeah, isn't right, it?
Yes, so there were a lot of these ideological debates, youths were very galvanized and activated. How did that affect
Mahathir you? Mahathir must have been at university
well,
with you.
Well, he was 2-3 years before me. and he was there, but he was not active at all. He was busy with his wife, with his girlfriend then.
So yeah. But didn't he have Chet Dead? He had Chet Dead at that time, didn't he?
Yeah, he already used that name, Chet Dead. Yeah.
So what was the experience like?
Well, as you said, Singapore was vibrant then. No, it was vibrant with especially left-wing activities. PAP then was supposed to be left-wing, you know. And of course, we knew then even, you know, who Lee Kuan Yew was. Yeah? And of course, there was very strong trade union. There were figures like Lim Chin Siong. And students were quite close, some of these political figures, invited them to the university for talks, invited union activists. And at the same time, of course, there was the media, the Malay media especially, Utusan Melayu at that time was very active. And the key figure then was Samad Ismail, you know, who had a very active past in politics. And it became the center of left-wing activities where ex-leftists were there, you know. We had Dahari Ali, we had Saleh Daud, you know, who were involved with the Parti Kebangsaan Melayu Melaya, the Malayan Nationalist Party then. And we had Chris Mas and Osman Awang, you know, who were sympathizers and even activists in the youth wing of PKMM.
And you could engage with them.
Now, the reason why I could engage was that I was secretary and then president of the Malay Language Society. And we had almost weekly talks by various people, you know, journalists, politicians, you know, and the university was free, you know. You could invite anybody without, you know, referring to HEP or whatever it was that did not exist then. And you had also a situation where in the university itself, there was a socialist club, and against it was the democratic club. And then there was always a competition between these clubs to control the union, student union.
I mean, the paradox, this was all happening under colonialism.
Exactly, exactly. And but it was not the environment decided this. It was the actors, you know, the students, as well as the newspapermen, journalists, and the unionists. And they were active in fighting against colonialism in order to improve their own condition, to get more freedom of the press, to get more opportunities to be creative and critical in the university.
Right. I guess, you know, I could have overstated that paradox, because the colonial authorities did at some point try to suppress the students.
They did.
Fajar trials were exemplary in
exactly,
that, right?
Yes, they did. They did. But I think despite that, I got the feeling that there was more, on one hand, room for discussion and for activism. And I think students and the others, the journalists and the unionists, were more committed to their cause than at present, I think.
Which point did you decide that you wanted to be an academic, to take this further in terms of, and rather than maybe becoming a politician or going into some other line of vocation?
Well, I received a Johor scholarship, which was quite substantial, no? There was a big amount of allowance and book allowance and all that, you know. And I was supposed to be serving the Johor government after graduating, but then I did not want to serve the Johor government in the civil service. And at that time, the state secretary came two or three times to me, you know, saying, "Now look, you have to work. You owe the university for the scholarship and all that." Well, I said, "Now look, I want to do my master's. Would you allow me?" Now he also had a master's from Cambridge, you know, and he knew, for instance, the importance of having such a degree. So he allowed me, and the Johor government released me to do a thesis. I wrote on social stratification in Kampung Bagan, which is in Johor. Now, this is a rural sociological kind of topic. And from that, two things happened. One, I was more interested in academic work. And two, I got a deeper interest in the rural Malay society. So the best thing to go to do was to develop this interest, these two interests, and join the university. And I had a chance to, of course, because once I obtained my master's, I was taken to the university.
Where did you do your master's?
Well, my master's was when I started in Singapore. At that time, the University of Malaya was in Singapore, but I completed it in Kuala Lumpur when the university now, and I completed it in 1962 and 63. I was made assistant lecturer at the University of Malaya. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you were born in 63.
I'm close. Yeah, a couple of years, more years than I would be born. What were the prevailing theories, during that period? Was it modernization theory that was framing the way peasant society and rural societies were being looked at by sociologists?
Not so much. Modernization and all this sort of thing. Although theories on modernization were already, talked a lot about in those days, but I think because there were a number of studies, especially in Latin America, they were done on rural society, and which was progressive or even Marxist in orientation, and as a result, there's a lot of such influence. And at the same time, of course, although a little later, there was the Vietnam War, and as you know, there was student activism, Vietnam War, and also the revival of Marxism in a number of universities, in America, France, and Britain, and that also had its influence here. And so, subjects like social stratification is just another name for class analysis. Yeah. So,
right.
In order to be safe, you call it social stratification.
What was it about social stratification in the rural context that captivated you as a researcher? And I think it must be a different world back then, kind of the rural Malay context, than it is today. What did you see that moved your questions? And was it a personal attachment to it? Was it, theoretical fascination? How did you relate to that context?
I think it's both, mm-hmm. But the theoretical thing came much later. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was related in a way to the situation because I already observed and I already was involved in a sense, with the rural society. I could see there were differences although ethnically it was homogeneous in the rural areas, but you can see differences in socioeconomic terms. You could see there were some very rich people and some people who have no land at all and very poor. And I wanted to see this, get the facts, about this, about land ownership, about tenancy and all that, and about differences of any income, differences in socioeconomic status, and how this influence again opportunities in society at large. So these created an interest.
I mean, there were a couple of, I think of names that you associate with the study of rural Malaysia. I guess James Scott would be one of the big names. And I think a number of people started there. I mean, Lim Teck Gee, I believe, also did some work on Felder. Mm-hmm. Diana Wong also did her work in rural Malaysia as a starting point for their own development as sociologists. It does seem like that was the dominant reality before Malaysia became, kind of industrialized and such, that this was how we needed to understand what the mainstream of Malaysia was like.
Yeah, of course, one of the earliest works was, of course, Raymond Perth, which was on the fishermen in Kelantan, And there was quite a great influence exerted by Unku Aziz in a way, although he does not write very much, But I think in the way he lectures and the way he interacts with students, he managed to create a lot of interest on rural society. And you talk about Scott was much later, of course, and you have Michael Swift and even Diana Wong and the rest of it. In fact, there is a rather large corpus of writings on Malay rural society or rural society as such. There are also Chinese rural society, and of course, Indian estate workers, Jayan, for instance, has done a lot of it.
And Michael Stenson. I think Wanzawawi also wrote about
workers,
peasants at the window of
Karanganu. Field work. Yeah. Fascinating stuff here, all this theoretical, contextual, and personal details woven into this really wonderful story. Dr. Syed, thank you for sharing. But let's take a pause right now, and we'll be back for more about the developments in Dr. Syed Hussein Ali's life. You're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutin, and this is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutin. As usual, we are joined this week by Dr. Syed Hussein Ali. And the first half of the show, we just went over the period of your, I guess, political and academic maturation. I do want to bring up your political involvement now, which I think was evident even from the early 60s, which is also one of the things that you're known for. And that is your activities with, I think it was Parti Rakyat Malaysia at that time.
That's right?
How did you get involved in the party, and what was it like?
Well, in university, there was, as I said, a lot of student activism, and there was the Socialist Club. I followed a number of their activities, but I was more concerned with other types of associations. I was with the Malay Language Society, with the Muslim Society, with the Gabungan Pelajar Melayu, you know, GPMS. In fact, at one time I was president of one, secretary of the other, and vice president of the third, you know. There was one particular graduate in the university. He often came to the university, you know, to meet students. He had been an ex-detainee, you know, detained under the British for being a member of the ABL, the Anti-British League, you know. Now, I became close to him, and he loved going around the country, you know, and I followed him, going all sorts of places. And at one time, we stopped at the Parti Rakyat headquarters in Kuala Lumpur, and there, the secretary lived just by the side of the office, and he was the brother of this graduate. Now, when we went there, there was a sort of informal meeting between Ahmad Bustamam, who was then president of Parti Rakyat, and Burhanuddin Helmi, and Isa Haji Muhammad. Three really legends, you know, of the left-wing activities in that house. And they invited us to the house, and we started talking. We talked for about an hour, but it was a very inspiring 1 hour, you know. They all talked about the experience and what they were hoping for the country, you know, and encouraged me, you know, look, you are a graduate, you shouldn't be trying to get positions in society. You should be also involved in society. Our independence is not really complete yet, you know, the social upliftment of the people, especially the poor, is not carried out in the proper way, you know. People like you should be involved. And that was how I was inspired. And when I went back to university, that was 1958, I immediately registered myself as a Parti Rakyat member. And that was way back in 58, you know. And when I did my master's, I was already involved in the committee of Parti Rakyat. In fact, when I was assistant lecturer, because I was made an assistant lecturer first, I was already a secretary of Parti Rakyat then, around 1963 or 64.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you feel, as many people suggest, that, you know, you can't be an academic and also have political commitments, that somehow your political commitments are going to distort your view of the world or your ability to be dispassionate, you know, or when analyzing society?
Well, in a way, both, you know, help each other, you know. And one thing about, for instance, as a lecturer, nobody could accuse me that I was using the classrooms for political propagation. Mm-hmm. You know, I was always praised by students as being a good lecturer, and I managed to publish more than others who don't participate in politics. And I could still commit myself, you know, strongly to my political ideas. And in my position as secretary then, I felt that I could do both. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are people who can do much better in those fields.
So this was around the 60s, and you pursued this up to throughout the 70s. But I also imagine that the administration was getting a bit stricter, tougher. There was an emergency happening. There was a Cold War scare. How did that climate affect your work?
Well, certainly the Cold War scare did affect, for instance, work in the Parti Rakyat. You know, because the government was all the time branding us as communists, as anti-religion and all that. And especially at that time, the president was, the late 60s, you know, Kasim Ahmad was president, and he wrote a poem, you know, where the last line of one poem said, Tuhan sudah mati, and they used that, you know, to discredit him. Now, but whatever it was, you know, the AUKU, the University and Colleges Act, had not been introduced then, and there was a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, I could be involved in politics and at the same time be Secretary General of Parti Rakyat in the late 60s, you know, despite being a lecturer. And it was only much later, after my detention in 1974, you know, that there was implementation of AUKU that disallowed political involvement of students and lecturers.
I mean, one of the things I remember reading your book, Do Ajao, Two Faces, was that while you were in detention, and this is really odd, correct me if I'm wrong, that you continued to supervise your master's students and you continued to do academic work while in detention in Kamuntik. Is that correct?
Exactly, yes. In fact, I produced 4 PhDs and 2 masters, you know, during that time. And I also produced a few books.
Wow.
You know? And in fact, whenever my students came, you know, they had special permission. Well, what happened was that I wrote to the ministry for permission to supervise the students. And of course, they won't recognize a detainee, you know, when he applies for anything. But the students wrote. And one of the students was a close relative of one of the officers there. And they arranged to come. And when they came, you know, they could sit with me for 2-3 hours to be supervised. And of course, my wife then was very jealous, you know. She could come only for half an hour.
One of the things about your book is that it does lay out this curious trap that you seem to be caught in sort of factional fighting in UMNO had affected you. That, you know, your extended detention had to do with some of the conflict in UMNO. Is that correct?
To a certain extent, yes. Because I think they wanted to particularly demonstrate to the lecturers, you know, that if you go against government, this is what is going to happen to you. You'll stay there long. You know? But at the same time, they considered me to be recalcitrant, you know, because every time they came, the special branch will come every 6 months, and they say, "Now look, do you regret for what you have done?" I said, "I have done nothing wrong. I don't regret anything." And so they say, "Now look, ini keras kepala, you know, hard headed,"
and that's a crime in this country.
Well, now of course it is. You know, yeah. Anything if you hold fast to any idea that is not the same as theirs, then you'll be punished for it.
Can you share a bit more to our listeners about your experience under detention and how that transformed you as an activist, as an educator?
As an activist, I think I became more committed and stronger, you know, in my belief that I should do something. That is one. If they think that detainees get killed, you know, in their spirit of activism or to sacrifice, then they are wrong. Because large number of them, the majority have come out stronger. Mm. That is one. Number two, of course, in a way, I thought the detention was a blessing. Of course, my wife suffered, my children suffered, you know. But in a blessing that I could do a lot of reading, I could do a lot of writing. In fact, I wrote a few books when I was in detention, you know. And, you know, like this, you were talking about Dua Wajah, Two Faces, you know. I wrote it in 11 days. You know, what happened was that when I was in detention, I was taken to Kuala Lumpur and put in solitary confinement for 6 months. So I had to keep my mind active because they wanted to destroy your mind in a way, you know. So what I did was to have a plan to write a book. I said, now look, I'm going to write about the Malays and about my experience. Now, about the Malays, I started by just thinking what I want to write chapter by chapter, you know, until I knew exactly during the 6 months what to write, you know, word by word almost, you know. And then when I was taken back to the camp after 6 months of solitary, I was put again in solitary in the camp itself, you know, separate from the others. And my wife brought carloads of material for me to read to strengthen my ideas that I had already formulated, you know. And as I said, with all these things done, I managed to write it in 2 weeks. Same too with the two faces. You know, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So, but that I did not write. I just noted down roughly what I had to do.
I'm curious now about reformasi, because I think that was another turning point in your career and in your political outlook. How was that experience for you? And what were the new questions or issues that came to your view at that time?
Well, as you know, Anwar was my student, you know, and he was a committed student, especially with rural, with the poor, you know, poor Malays especially. And I had strong sympathy for him and for what he was doing. And secondly, of course, at that time, there was a mass movement. You know, what happened to Anwar created a mass movement that almost we haven't seen before, you know. The Malay society was split right in the middle, you know. And at that time, of course, Parti Rakyat was almost marginalized, you know, being called communist and all that, you know. And we had to have some kind of broad base. And so we thought, now look, there must be strong cooperation between Parti Rakyat and at that time, Parti
Keadilan Nasional. Yeah.
So that, you know, you have the combination of experience and ideas of Parti Rakyat and the mass following of Keadilan. And it so happened at that time, Anwar wrote from prison to suggest that there should be a sort of cooperation. Now, when we were earlier together with Tengku Razali in the Gagasan and all that, now Tengku Razali so often asked us to be involved with Semangat 46 at the time and to merge, you know. We just refused because we knew exactly the feudal character of the leadership and very pro-Malay kind of orientation, you know. And but in the case of Keadilan, it was different. It was not, you know, the leaders who were determining things, but it was the people at large. The reformasi movement was changing things.
Did you ever turn your pen to the question of why a left-orientated party with the explicit agenda, a popular agenda, right, for the majority, could not mobilize? Why it is identitarian politics that UMNO promoted trumped the class politics of Parti Rakyat and parties like it?
Well, there are several reasons, of course. One, historically, you know, even right from the period of pre-independence, there was a strong movement of whose orientation was very much Malay, you know. And it was not just Malay, but it was anti-Chinese, anti-Indian, much more than anti-British, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have that situation, one. And this continued. And the Malayan Union, for instance, showed, you know, that it was the Malay sentiments that really united the people to oppose the British idea of Malayan Union at that time. And I saw it as not only anti-Malayan Union, but also the desire for Malays to promote their identity by making sure that the rulers will remain rulers, you know, because the Malayan Union had removed much of their powers. You know? So, in other words, this Malay Islam kind of orientation had always been strong in our society, and it was easily used or abused by the government in order to repress, especially movements that are multi-ethnic and that are progressive in nature. But the reform RC showed that there was a change. There was a change that, you know, people could think and act according to the various ethnic identities, you know, and also they could be progressive in their ideas. Mm-hmm. And that's why we thought that by linking ourselves with Keadilan at that time, we would be able to, of course, do a better job of the party. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very interesting take, because I think even today we see the strong grip and influence that identity politics has on the Malay political imagination. That's very, very hard to shrug, you know, because it has all these institutional bolsters and, you know, financial incentives and so forth. How about today? We are in 2016 now. Malaysia has become more urbanized, more industrialized. How do you view that sort of identity politics? Does it still have a future, or is it at its last legs?
Unfortunately, you know, there are so many aspects of our society that is getting worse, you know. It's getting more corrupt. It's getting more undemocratic and, in a way, more autocratic. And as a result, you know, in order to save their skin, the powers that be turn to religion and race. So undermining all the situation is actually this strong sentiments of race and ethnicity, which are being actually flamed by powers that be in order to stay in power. Mm-hmm. Now, this kind of development, I think, is bad for the country. And what with the economic situation now, the 1 MDB and the 2.6 billion, no, it's really causing not only undermining the political situation in this country, but also undermining the image and name of the country overseas. You know, now there has to be enormous kind of change, you know, so that it will be a complete overhaul of the political and, if possible, the economic structure of the country, so that the concern would be not personal power, not personal wealth, but, you know, mm-hmm. the upliftment of the great majority of people who are Malays, Indians, Chinese, Kadazan and Iban and all that. So we have to look at that from that perspective, the perspective of the lower class, so to say, you know, which are multi-ethnic. And at the same time, that approach will still help the Malays, mm-hmm. because the majority of those in the lowest rung of society are Malays. The poor, about two-thirds or even more of the poor among the various ethnic groups are Malays. So I think there shouldn't be any fear to take a non-ethnic approach to development, because ultimately, if you take it in class terms, in socio-economic terms, it will help the poor whose majority are the Malays.
2016 represents the 60th year since you joined university. Did at any point cynicism or despair creep into you? I mean, you don't sound like you're despairing or cynical.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you despair? And did you want to give up?
At no point I felt despair or wanted to give up, because I have full faith in the people. And I think the people will ultimately change, and they will change the country and the society. And, you know, for me, as I said, the various experiences that I have, especially the prison and all that, strengthened me. And my faith, I think, to a certain extent, in religion, makes me strong. You know, because of any, you feel, you know, that ultimately what is right, you know, will prevail.
There you have it, folks, the life and times of Dr. Syed Hussein Ali. But before we end, as usual, we have recommendations for our listeners. If you want to look more into the ideas that Dr. Syed has worked on over the years, or more about his very illustrious life, what do you have in mind, Sharat?
Oh, well, there are a few things. I mean, there's the prison books. I mean, Dua Wajah and Two Faces. And it could be read in tandem with Kasim Ahmad's University Kedua. And I mean, there is, a solid body of work around, you know, the experience of being in prison. But What's that?
Kwa, for instance.
And Kwa mm-hmm. Kyasung mm-hmm. as well. There's that. I think that that's a personal insight into your experience as a person, more so than you as a social scientist. But so that would be my recommendation.
Well, mm-hmm. people know more of that book, you know. And it was also a book that sold very well because I managed to buy a Volvo with it.
Oh, wow, really? Very good. I'm glad I contributed. I think I bought both. I read both the Malay and the English version.
But on the other hand, you know, I also had more serious books, you know, like The Malays, Their Problems and Future.
I was just going to recommend that. Yeah, very good.
I think that's one book that should be read. And also there is Ethnic Relations, you know, in Malaysia.
And your more recent book on the royalty as well.
The royalty is a small book, but I was hoping that it would get banned. but they decided not to ban it.
Well, along with Zaid Ibrahim's Ampun Tuanku and what's his name, Bari?
Aziz
Bari's book. I mean, these are three very new books, very important because the Institution of the Royalty has come to the fore again after many years.
Yeah. What I would suggest to listeners to go on Google Scholar, scholar.google.com, just type Dr. Syed's name and you'll see a lot of the papers you wrote on social stratification, the Malay context. And it's been really of immeasurable value for my own work, because if you really want to know the socioeconomic context for the Malays in the 70s and 80s, even from the 60s, you cannot do that without citing your work. So you've been of tremendous contribution to our intellectual tradition here. In any case, do you tweet by any chance? Are you on social media?
Yes, Manish? I do. You know? Okay.
Yeah, I follow you.
And what's your handle?
What do you mean? I don't
Oh, handle as in the name on Twitter. Like.
Oh, okay. It's up on the Syed Hussein Ali.
Oh, Syed Hussein Ali. Yeah. Okay. Mm. And Sharad,
I'm at Sharad Kutin.
At Sharad Kutin. You're always welcome to email the show. That's bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Just forward us your questions, thoughts, comments, and we can share it with Dr. Syed. In any case, thank you for listening. Thank you, Dr. Syed, for joining
thank
us and sharing.
Thank you very much for having me here.
I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Sharad Kutin, as usual. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.